RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Wednesday morning means it's time for our Legal Hub here at RCR. Joining us this morning, Sean Rush, Wellington-based barrister, holding a Master's in Law and a Master's in Climate Change Science and Policy. He's a former Wellington City Councillor and ACT Party candidate for Otaki. He's the president of the Public Interest Law and Science Initiative, a not-for-profit which brings honest and accurate science to decision makers to deliver evidence-based policy and lawmaking. Sean, welcome to our Legal Hub program for this Wednesday morning. I hope you're well.
Very good, thanks. Nice to be back.
All right, some meaty issues, some that you are more connected with than others, maybe, though we'll find out. So the headline yesterday in the Herald, an Auckland paper reporting a Wellington story. Wellington City Council woes. Simeon Brown appoints Crown Observer. Tory Whanau refuses to quit. Which bit of that do you want to start with?
Well, first of all, let's just start with Tory's position. There's absolutely no reason why she should quit. This is a Crown Observer appointment. And I've been through a similar process when I was a Wellington City Councillor in the last triennium. Where we had an investigator interview us and do a report about the dysfunction that was the city council then. And it was a thoroughly enjoyable and learning experience for all of us. A lot of positives came out of it. So I think Tory will be looking forward to having an independent person who can actually see what a few things are going on there that are not really actually Tory's fault. But we'll wait and see what he or she says and who the appointment is in another time. But, you know, there's a backstory to this, Paul, and I'm happy to sort of take the listeners through that. I mean, in the last triennium when I was a city councillor, out of nowhere, the officers presented an option to sell the airport shares. It came from nowhere. The mayor had no idea about it. And it was presented in isolation, which meant that we would go to the community and consult on it. And actually, the whole thing got shut down pretty quickly and with a bit of a rap on the knuckles to the officers. Don't try that again. So I was really surprised to see that it's come back like a zombie in this triennium. And no one campaigned on it again. It's been promoted again by officers, not by elected members. And I think this is one concern that I think are generally shared across the political spectrum, is that officers are actually leading the agendas and agenda items at Wellington City Council and not so much elected members. And this is a pretty good example of it.
Well, it shouldn't operate like that, should it? The other thing is, what was the need to sell the shares about? Deficits, pulling money in for other projects? What was the reasoning for that at the time, the first time?
Well, the reasoning presented was similar to what it was in the previous term when I was a councillor and read the papers pretty thoroughly. And it's got some merit, right? You've got about a $300 million asset there. It's exposed to Wellington's earthquake risk and other risks. And it would be better if that fund was sitting, you know, in Auckland shares or something like that. So, you know, there's a certain amount of sense. But when I really kick the tires on that, you realize that when the big one hits, no one's going to care who owns the shares in the airport. The government will probably nationalise the asset to get it back up and running. And I was on the board of trustees of Sky Stadium, which is a big Wellington asset, probably $1 billion to rebuild. It's only insured to $200 odd million, and we decided actually we weren't going to insure it for a rebuild because it was simply going to cost too much. And that the council would have other priorities when the payout happened. It wouldn't be used to rebuild the stadium. You know, it'd be used to get the hospital up and running, that sort of thing. So, you know, I sort of think it's more complicated than that. The big problem with the way it was presented to some councillors this time was that it was presented as the funds would be held in what was described as a perpetual fund for green projects, which is all well and good if you're a Green Party supporter. But, you know, for the rest of us in Wellington who want to see just simply good investment, pay down debt, some prudent and prudent fiscal responsibility, that sort of was another reason why actually this might not be such a good idea. And if we could, I mean, I just sort of thought, well, if you want to invest in a fund, you know, go to one of the Kiwi Bank ones and do that. Or else, you know, you could trade the shares for shares in Infratil, who've got the, you know, the big portfolio that's international, and that would insulate you. It all smelled a little bit too contrived it, from my perspective. But the issue, I suppose, in terms of the legalities of this got quite complex, because this time the officers put it into the long-term plan. Now, that means that it'll be consulted on, but consulted on with all the vast other things that are incidental to a 10-year plan for the city. So it could get very easily buried away. And it wasn't until very late in the day that it was realised, firstly, that the long-term plan subcommittee had effectively the power to approve this plan. And that committee has mana whenua reps who are unelected, and had signalled, and indeed they did, vote to sell the shares, which is contrary to the sort of kaupapa of Labour Party members and Green Party members, which is to hold on to public assets, although it's a long bow to draw, Paul, to call a 30-odd percent holding in a private company a public asset. I just always thought nonsense. Yeah. It was mischief-making, and I felt in the last triennium that was used to make the mayor at that time look bad. And I fear that actually some of the votes in this particular occasion were also cast not in the interest of Wellington, but to make the mayor look bad. And I thoroughly regret that, and I hope it wasn't true. But
wait on, so to make the mayor look bad, but she's a Green.
Yes, but she's supported it. She's put her sort of mana on the line, and that's, you know, the same thing happened with Shelley Bay in the last triennium. You've got this sort of combination of left-wing guys and right-wing guys ganging up on the mayor. And, you know, it may well, I might be overstating it, because I say there are very good reasons why you wouldn't want to sell this asset. But nonetheless, it did cause, you know, some disruption for the mayor, but she's handled it pretty well. And now we've got a Crown Observer who I think is going to, you know, provide a little bit of sanity amongst what was also in the last triennium a pretty dysfunctional and at times heated bunch of folks.
So that observer's role is to keep an eye on what exactly?
Oh, well, shadow the mayor and the CEO. I think it's a full-time role. I mean, there was a little bit of discussion amongst legal circles, and one of the prominent public law professors at Victoria University was of the view that there wasn't really sufficient for the minister to even appoint a Crown Observer, let alone commissioners. And whilst I agreed on the commissioner's point, the test for appointment is pretty broad, and that is that he must on reasonable grounds have thought that there's a significant problem relating to the local authority. Well, you know, the last minister, Naima Huta, she appointed commissioners on a lot less, you know, and it's interesting actually, because that was a centre-right council that got thrown out, and that was because of a claim that they could never agree. I mean, well, we can all agree because there's a casting vote. So I always felt that, nevertheless, that the threshold to appoint someone to be an observer surely had to be a lot less than the threshold to appoint commissioners. And I'm going to guess that that's the advice that Minister Brown has taken. I actually reached out to Tory a few or last week and said that, you know, what the previous mayor had done when the calls for commissioners were circling was to actually appoint his own investigator who'd also been involved with the Tauranga appointment. And that actually fulfilled the same sort of purpose, but without the sort of negative overtone of the government having to stand in. But she thought that was a good idea, but maybe the minister's got his own thoughts. So there you go. That's Wellington City Council. You know, I don't expect to see any judicial review challenging that decision.
It's interesting because Tory Whanau comes in for, what would you call it? Yeah, attacks. And besmirching of her character is common, especially on social media. And if you were in Wellington for any length of time seeing pipes burst, it would be easy to look towards someone like her as, you know, incompetent and not focusing on the actual things. But this sounds like what this could reveal. The commissioner, the observer, going in there is kind of seeing the role that the officers have been taking. That would be exposed then, would it, or potentially anyway?
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity there for, you know, for someone to get under the hood and to maybe have a look at some of how those votes were cast and trace things back. But, you know, we'll see. But just, politically, I'm not on the same part of the spectrum as Tory. And, you know, some of the antics have been sort of awkward, no question. But I just don't see the point in bagging someone. You know, we're supposed to be championing our city, and she's doing her bit in her own way. And I think that the right time for the people of Wellington to make a complaint is in October next year. Yep. And in the meantime, you know, either don't say anything or provide some sort of support, which is what I've been trying to do, actually since she got elected.
Yeah, but a lot of the plans that have been put into action now have caused big problems for retailers, for a start. I mean, some big names have gone down recently, Sean.
Yeah.
And they're blaming this perpetual work cycle on roads and stuff. No one's really given a thought too much for how it will impact on everyday people, their businesses, etc. And that all gets conflated, doesn't it, into a picture of incompetence and something dodgy's going on somewhere.
I think so. I mean, you know, people say you get what you vote for, and you, without doubt, when Mayor Whanau was appointed, it was well known that she would be championing cycleways throughout the city. So the 60% of people that didn't get off their backsides to vote can take some responsibility. But that, you know, let's not forget, Paul, she won by a landslide.
Right.
I think Andy Foster got 19,000. She got 30 odd. So, yeah. Yes, you know, so that's where we are. But I mean, I think what I observed during the campaign was a lack of any real vision other than, you know, not just from Tory. Paul Eagle, if you might recall, he stood as a local MP, and you know, Paul's vision was he was going to hold a review. Tory's vision was of a low carbon, walkable city. We've all heard all that sort of stuff before. And Andy was having to campaign on a long-term plan that he never really believed in, but got voted into. So you just haven't had someone who's captured the imagination of the city and said, this is what we should be doing. I'm hearing you. I've got the Heritage Park out in Miramar. We've got the, we've got the pools that people love. We've got the infrastructure that needs to be, you know, sorted. And and saying that loud and proud, and I, you know, just having to maybe take a different sort of approach than what's been taken lately.
But you mean like an old-style campaigning approach?
Yeah, it's a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah, so bring it back.
Someone might stand up on a stump and go, well, these are the five things that I want to achieve. I know they're going to be difficult. You need to back me, and if you want to back me, here are the people that you need to also back, and we'll get cracking.
Before we get off this, just going back to the airport shares, okay, I take your point that it's a shareholding in a company, not, you know, hard dirt, let's say, directly owned. But should a plan like that to sell an asset which was generated, I think, by the Wellington City Council? They built the thing back in the day. It was their surveyors, because I know my grandfather was part of that team, who built the thing, to actually ask ratepayers whether they want it or not?
So that's what I said before. So strategic assets of the city have to go out for consultation if you want to sell them. And as much as I would say the asset itself is fairly benign in terms of control, the simple fact of its value makes it strategic. So you would have to go out to the ratepayers and say, do you want us to sell it? So, and that's the unfortunate thing in this process, though, was it was thrown into the long-term plan. So it was going to be one of 100 things.
Yeah, so that was sneaky. That was sneaky, right?
I won't say anything on that, but one thing it did give rise to was the status of the Mana Whenua representatives,
right? Yeah,
on the subcommittee. So what happens is that the council get elected, and then they do the delegations of authority to various subcommittees. They don't have to, but they generally do. And the subcommittee for the long-term plan, along with the other major subcommittees, have included with them two Mana Whenua representatives who've got full voting rights and get paid the same as the other councillors. And they took the view that actually it would be far better to sell this asset. You know, they actually took a bit of a centre-right view, which...
Okay, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, exactly right. So, and I've heard actually some feedback from one of the Labor councillors is that they often take a centre-right view.
Okay.
So it's, in a left-wing city, we're appointing representatives that vote centre-right. So, you know, who would have thought? But nonetheless, it got particularly awkward because the delegation was a full delegation, which meant, bizarrely, that the city council, the elected members, couldn't actually reject the long-term plan and amend it and fix the bits about the airport. They only had the power to reject it or accept it, which I find a little bit odd, because my sort of training in law and the law of delegations is such that once, if you are the delegator, you can... you can overstep whatever your delegatee says at any stage. But that was the feedback that was coming back from the legal counsel at the city council. So that's an interesting nuance. So I'm going to guess that the next delegations will say that the committee will develop the long-term plan and present it for adoption, rejection, or amendment to the city council next time round. Of course, the Mana Whenua reps are all upset because they quite rightly, I think, felt that this was a test of the council's partnership with them, and that they didn't, when the push comes to shove and the council didn't like what the Mana Whenua reps said, they went against them. And I have some sympathy with that, Paul, but I mean, I supported the appointment of the Mana Whenua reps in the last triennium, but it was always recognised that it was all decisions were subject to the democratically elected people, right. And that's how I managed to square that with some of the people who were very concerned about, the one person, one vote, the democratic value being lost.
Okay, so this appointment of an observer, just to wrap this bit of it, actually is a kind of a relief for Tori Whanau, because if she's been in a tough position through other people manoeuvring in certain ways, then this might show that up and cut her a bit of slack.
So Paul, I mean, I never knew Tori at all before she got elected. Well, I mean, until she put her hand up. I was always concerned that even someone who has extraordinary experience in the political space, if you haven't actually been on council, it's a very, very different process. The processes, you've got the three-year cycle, you've got different things that need to be done along the way. And if you've got some really good people around you, maybe you could do it, right? But what I understand is that Tori has surrounded herself with Green Party folks who've never been on council either. And have sort of led her, I think, in a direction that may not have been positive for her. I think that if Tori's smart, and I think she is, she'll grab this Crown Observer with both hands and say, right, how do I do this?
Yeah, help me out here.
Yeah.
Okay, in the time we've got left, Sean, Gauri Skaraman's appeal to have her shoplifting convictions wiped has been dismissed by the High Court, with Justice Venning saying that there's no evidence that the Law Society would reject her law practicing certificate based on this conviction. Is that normal? I mean, what do you have to do before you can have a practicing certificate rejected?
Well, first of all, Paul, it's been a long time since I was a criminal defence lawyer, but I was a criminal defence lawyer in Napier, and the sort of folks that I dealt with weren't lawyers. They were typically young Māori men, and not one of them ever said, look, can you please try and get me a discharge without conviction, because it's going to affect my job, right, or the fact that I can't travel anymore. I just thought this was just showed so much disrespect to those young boys. I was furious when I saw that she was going to have a crack at this. So I'm personally thrilled that it's been upheld. But it is an interesting little nuance that came out of that, which was she was saying that the conviction would actually inhibit her chances of keeping a practicing certificate. And the judge quite rightly said, well, actually, that's not the case. The Law Society is going to look at your character, and whether you've got a conviction against your name or not, what you have done will be part of that record. And so on that basis, the conviction was upheld, and the discharge application failed. I still think about it. I don't think I had many guys in my day that had stolen more than $10,000 worth of stuff or sold $10,000 of drugs.
Yep.
So just the privilege
the privilege.
These Green Party people tell us about privilege, and here they are, the privilege of being an international lawyer, being a member of parliament, and then going off and shoplifting, and then telling us it's all about, your own personal issues and
mental
all that
health.
Stuff.
Yep.
Mental health. And then having the gall to then say, well, this is going to affect my work. Well, tough.
Should have thought of that, maybe.
Yeah, I just don't get it. I'm still angry about it. But there you go. Justice was done.
Is that bad legal advice to her? Though she should know what good legal advice is, surely.
She's lucky not to be doing 6 months,
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, $10,000 of theft. If I walked into a dairy and took $10,000 out of there, you expect to go away for that, wouldn't you?
If you say so. Okay, that didn't happen. All right, and to wrap up, we've had Gary Judd on before, and we had chap from the Free Speech Union, sorry, the name off the top of my head escapes me, it'll come to me, talking about tikanga in the law. We've talked about it on this program before with contributors. So I think Gary Judd made his presentation his submission to a select committee about a week ago. I saw a bit of it, and he puts things in a very clear way, I thought, what I saw of that. But do you think this, and that relates to Auckland University Law School, of course, but do you think that tikanga is going to eventually spill in to, what would we call it, common law, really? The Supreme Court said it was the first law. Remember the first law they said it was?
You know why they call it the common law? It was because, the 12th century in the feudal system, each little fiefdom had their own sort of ways of doing things.
Right, yeah.
Different rules, different penalties, different sentences, and the king's bench would actually go round and standardise what the laws were, so they were common.
Okay, makes sense.
This tikanga idea, which is, it's basically a form of house rule, so we're not talking about the mana whenua of Wellington have got particular rules. This goes right to each family's rules.
Yeah. Well, even an individual.
Arguably.
If you look at the Mike Smith
case. None of us, the beauty of the British common law system is the doctrine of precedent. I can go to a law library, I can look up what happened when the last time someone in my situation either got caught or breached a contract or something like that. I can look and with some sort of, expectation to be treated in the same manner. That doesn't apply when you don't know what the rules are, and the rules are not available to you. They're not written down. So what Gary's saying, you know, has got a lot of merit, but I've seen on places like LinkedIn that people are really bad mouthing him. I studied the treaty in 1990. I studied customary international law in around that time as well. But back in those days, there was long-standing principles about when custom would be included in the common law. It was very limited. It needed to be long-standing, very similar to what the Foreshore and Seabird Act tests were. And that's slow. And the impact of tikanga historically has been in the form of very, very bespoke statutory legislation, you know, a Native Title Act, for example, legislation where native custom is directly spelled out as being important because of Maori land legislation, for example, not the general population where a Pākehā man dies and the court, who aren't satisfied with submissions they've got from both sides of the argument, tell them to go away and tell them, well, how would this be dealt with under tikanga?
Is that the Ellis case?
It's the Ellis case, and that case actually just completely pulled the plug on over 100 years of the doctrines of how customary international law was applied in places like New Zealand in a very measured sense where deference was paid without doubt, but it was quite limited. It needed to be well understood. It needed to never be in conflict with existing legislation. And the one of the justices on the Supreme Court considered that to be a colonial relic.
Yeah.
She described it and just threw it away. So, you know, I don't for a moment as a commercial barrister think that my practice is ever going to be impacted by tikanga. But as a criminal defence lawyer, I can see how arguments might be made, but they're probably similar to ones I would have made anyway. It wouldn't help Galleries either, I should imagine, but you never know. I just think it's throwing up a lot of uncertainty. But I would also say, Paul, that there's also a bit of scaremongering out there as well. I mean, I've taken some time to have a really good look at it, to inform myself, see what the Law Commission has said. And, you know, I learned in my first year at law in 1987 a course that was a compulsory course called Law and Society, which took us through how the Indonesian tribes put together morality and how those might form into laws and norms and that sort of thing. And I also always wondered why we weren't studying this in the Māori context. So the idea that you might be able to take some of those things and learn a bit of history, learn a bit of tikanga, I don't think is such a bad thing. But then again, it could be an optional course for folks as well.
That comment you made about LinkedIn, what are they saying about, because you'd think learned, smart, rational people who can see these arguments would, wouldn't have trouble understanding that, yet they're still kind of putting the boot in, are they?
Yeah, I honestly find it bizarre. As you say, you know, smart people, experienced in the law, but you need not go further to Auckland University's Dean of Law and what she said about Gary. I mean, this is sort of radical sort of stuff. There it's important to realise there's always two sides of a story, and Gary's got one I probably align more with, but, you know, you need to keep a mind open. The unfortunate thing is that even on LinkedIn, these discussions are quite polarising very quickly. And, you know, I thought about doing a post to record my sort of views and just thought I just don't need to get up in the morning tomorrow and find a big pylon on Sean Rush. I get them enough for other things like climate change and being a city councillor.
Do you want any more?
Yeah, exactly right.
All right, Sean, good catching up with you and picking your legal brain on our Legal Hub for this Wednesday. Look forward to chatting again. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I look forward to hearing from Gary next week. So thanks very much, Paul. All the best, mate.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.